coming up on Weekend America.
Robert Prechter predicted the housing and credit crisis back in 2002. So how is Prechter's company doing going into 2009?
My guess is we'll be a little oasis here. We're actually doing some hiring. And if we can get the message out and help a few more people before they get hurt, that's a good thing.
I'm John Moe. Some sectors are taking on staff, but layoffs loom in the comic strip industry.
So as things get bad in the real world, things get worse for Dilbert, and so they're going to get real bad in a few weeks here for Dilbert.
A chat with Dilbert creator Scott Adams about the workplace, the economy, and Dilbert's impending layoff. What exactly did Dilbert do at his job anyway? And we hear your New Year's resolutions.
My New Year's resolution for this year is to have fewer sense of humor failures.
We'll see if we can help with that. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Welcome to the first weekend of 2009. Kind of a weird way it's laid out this year. New Year's Day is on a Thursday, so Friday it's back to work, but I kind of wonder how much work really got done. Admit it, America, this is really the second half of your four-day weekend. We now have less than a year to go to decide on a name for this decade, by the way. The aughts never really caught on, did it? Any other ideas? We're running out of time here, people. Come on. We're talking about your 2009 New Year's resolutions this hour, but have you kept your resolutions for 2008?
Yes, I have, because I resolved years ago not to make any New Year's resolutions.
I lost the weight that I hoped to lose, and I worked on a webpage.
Well, I kept one. I went to school.
I obviously didn't lose that 50 pounds that I wanted to get rid of.
Some of the ones that I've kept involve eating a lot healthier, exercising a lot more. I've converted to a bicycle as my primary mode of transportation.
I've only ever kept one New Year's resolution, and that was to eat 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. I recommend it.
I'm impressed. Those people are good. Or they're liars. Those voices came from Fairbanks, Alaska, Chicago, San Francisco, St. Louis, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Washington, D.C. As we look ahead to 2009, one of the most pressing questions we ask is, will our economy get better or worse? And how do we find any answer that is anything but pure shoulder-shrugging speculation? It's natural to turn to sources who predicted the economic disaster all along to get some guidance. You know who I'm talking about, the bears, the doctors of doom, the Cassandras of Wall Street. Do you know the story of Cassandra? It's from Greek mythology. She could predict the future, but no one would believe her. Weekend America's Julia Barton wonders what the myth has to teach us now.
There are many, many videos on YouTube under the title, Peter Schiff Was Right.
Why do you think that a recession is coming? Just how bad is it going to be?
I think it's going to be pretty bad. And whether it starts in 07 or 08, I think, is immaterial. And I also think it's going to last not just for quarters, but for years.
And just like Cassandra in the Greek tragedies, Peter Schiff is surrounded by a chorus of skeptics on cable financial news shows.
I think Peter is just totally off base, and I don't think it's going to be... I mean, I just don't know where he's getting his stuff. The
well, one of us is off base, but it's definitely not me.
Schiff is author of the 2007 book Conquer the Crash, and he's an ardent believer that only the free market, not government, can solve our fiscal problems. So despite being the star of Peter Schiff Was Right, right now Peter Schiff is not happy.
You would think that somebody in government would want to say, let's get this guy's opinion. Why don't we go to the guy that was warning us all along, right, who everybody else was laughing at? Let's see what he thinks. And that's what's frustrating, because I know exactly what needs to be done.
So yes, Schiff says he feels like he has something in common with Cassandra. When she shows up as a character in the 5th century BC tragedy, the Agamemnon, she also complains to the chorus that no one listens to her.
And the first thing the chorus says after that is, they say, but we believe you.
That's Whitman College professor of classics Dana Burgess, who, you should also know, co-authored The Complete Idiot's Guide to Classical Mythology. Burgess points out the paradox of the Cassandra story. The audience, of course, does believe her. They know she's right when she predicts the fall of her hometown of Troy. In the Agamemnon, the chorus also gives her the benefit of the doubt, until she starts talking about really, really bad things still to come. Years of revenge and murder and misery for their world.
The chorus is kind of freaked out by the whole thing, and they express some kind of dubiousness about prophets in general, and Cassandra in particular. And they don't like what she's saying. They don't really want to hear this stuff. And so they're pretty discombobulated by Cassandra.
So 2009, I should be hiding under the covers most of the time?
No, you should certainly be hiding your money from the government. You should hide it from Ben Bernanke by getting out of the dollar. You know,
should I be buying gold on my credit cards?
Well, you should buy gold with cash. I mean, you know, buying it with a credit
card. I don't have any. I work in public radio.
Well, I mean, you could stock up on food then. I mean, you could buy, okay. You know, you could buy things that won't perish. You could buy batteries, you know, things that'll last for a while, because those things are going to get a lot more expensive in the future. You might as well buy them now.
Batteries. Peter Schiff, the country's most popular prophet of doom, is telling me hyperinflation is on the way, and I need to stock up on batteries. So, do I? Seriously, do you? Or do I look for a sign that he's not a true prophet?
It's funny. When people don't really like what you have to say or think you're completely wrong, it's difficult to enjoy that experience.
Robert Prechter has been predicting economic trends for more than three decades. His book, Conquer the Crash, came out in 2002.
And if suddenly they say, oh, you're the smartest person that's come down the pike in a while, anyone in this business should know better than to enjoy that either, because it simply means you're about to be wrong.
Like Peter Schiff, Prechter's a libertarian, but he doesn't sound totally gloom and doom. He has a more cyclical view of our current crisis.
There's a deep valley ahead, but we'll get to it pretty quickly and come out the other side. And a few years after it's over, it'll be a distant memory for the history books. It's a sad thing, but it's also a natural thing. The ebb and flow of social mood from optimism to pessimism simply is part of the human experience.
To everything, there is a season. It's an ancient, if not specifically Greek, point of view. And Professor Dana Burgess says the ancient Greeks actually distrusted prophets. As Cassandra sees the end of her life approaching in the Agamemnon, she rips the tokens of her prophet's status from her robes and throws them on the ground.
I think she recognizes that knowing what will be is not a good thing. And, you know, we might say, well, we want to know what's going to happen next week. You know, is my boss going to give me a raise or whatever? But she, I think in that moment, sort of reveals that knowing the future is a kind of curse.
Only fools and the cursed are certain of what will come in that world. So maybe it's best to leave those batteries on the shelf and hope for the best. In St. Paul, I'm Julia Barton for Weekend America. I don't know, John. I'm thinking 9 volts are the way to go.
9 volts, you think? Not double A?
Everybody's going to have double A.
How about the rechargeable that you plug into the wall? Or can we count on the electricity coming out of the wall?
We'll see.
Thanks, Julia. We thought we'd take a few more looks at some other Cassandras this week to get their takes on what 2009 holds in store. We asked you for some ideas of your Cassandras, Cassandrae. Bill Fenstermaker of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, wrote on our Facebook page that he'd like to hear from Scott Adams, the creator of the comic strip Dilbert. Made sense to us. Dilbert chronicles work culture with all of its daily frustrations and humiliations and incompetence. It's been that kind of 2008, certainly, in the American workplace. So the guy who makes the strip must have a good read on 09. Scott Adams began Dilbert 20 years ago during the recession of the late 1980s. Scott Adams, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Do you have any New Year's resolutions for 2009?
Oh, I try not to have any New Year's resolutions, but this year is a little different. This is my first time talking on radio in probably 3.5 years because I had a bizarre neurological condition that prevented me from even speaking for that most of that time. Mm. And I recently had an operation that fixed it against all odds. And so my goal had been that I would get my voice back to normal, but then also get it to a perfect state.
I think you sound great.
Thanks.
Are comic strips Cassandras, are comic strips able to foretell the future and bad times to come? Did Dilbert call this all along, Scott?
Well, I think Garfield does that. He's foretelling a future of cats that walk upright and steal your lasagna. But,
and complain about Mondays even though they don't have jobs.
Yeah, but Dilbert's more of a snapshot of the present. Ah. So as things get bad in the real world, things get worse for Dilbert, and so they're going to get real bad in a few weeks here for Dilbert.
How bad are they going to get?
He will lose his job.
Really?
He will be jobless, yes.
Ah. How do you go about reacting to the news of the day? I mean, is it just by feel, or is it a very considered way of commenting on what's happening in the workplace?
Well, first of all, I work, you know, a month or two ahead, so I have to guess what's still going to be a problem in a month or two.
Yeah.
So I think I'm safe saying that the economy isn't going to turn around anytime too quickly.
Okay.
I feel pretty confident about that. But otherwise, I just get email from people, and they say this is what's bugging me, and I turn it into a comic.
What's funny about what's going on right now?
Well, let me give you a little description of the way I see it. So in order for the economy to improve right now, you would need the government to do two things. You would need them to first understand what they need to do, and secondly, execute it properly. Now, the only things you know that can't happen in the future is the government won't know what to do, and if they did, they won't execute it properly. But there's still hope, because they might get the wrong solution of what they should do, but then execute it improperly and accidentally hit the right solution. So there's absurdity, you know, abounds, and that's good for my business.
Is bad business good for the Dilbert business? Does interest in Dilbert go up in times like these?
Yeah, I've been watching my web hits and how many people reprint my comics on blogs, and it just spiked in the last month or two. So I'm a little like an undertaker, you know, when things are bad for everybody else, I'm embarrassed about it, and I can't say I'm happy about it, but things certainly pick up on my end of things.
Your new book, Dilbert 2.0, compiles 20 years of Dilbert. What's struck you most about the way Dilbert has evolved?
It was actually kind of interesting to watch how the trends went during the 20 years. Dilbert was born when there was a lot of downsizing and the economy was kind of limping along. And he was hugely popular because he was kind of the poster boy for downsizing. But then when he hit the dot-com era, I literally couldn't find anybody to complain about their job for a few years. And it was tough to write the strip because everybody thought, well, if I'm not already a billionaire, it's probably my own fault. You know, I should go out and start my own dot-com company. How hard could it be? And, you know, now watching the pendulum swing back, it's kind of interesting to see the whole context there.
Scott Adams is the creator of Dilbert. His latest book is Dilbert 2.0, 20 Years of Dilbert.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Small groups of supporters meeting in private homes helped Obama win. But now that the election is over, why are those meetings still happening? Next on Weekend America. Thank you. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. It's less than 3 weeks until Barack Obama takes the oath of office, becomes president. A big reason why is that during the campaign, his team was astoundingly effective at mobilizing volunteers, getting citizens, voters, to be stakeholders in the campaign. Supporters became phone bank workers from home. They were given specific routes of houses to go ring doorbells at, and they held meetings in their own homes. Obama won, but that apparatus is still in place. House meetings are still going on. Last month, there were 2,000 House meetings across all 50 states, including one in Brooklyn, New York. Our tape recorders were rolling as Obama supporters talked about the coming presidency and their roles in it.
You got to do a mic test or something. My name is Reverend Herman Hamilton, testing 1, 2, 3, Herman Hamilton, and I'm the president for the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization.
I will listen to you, especially when we disagree. And above all, I will ask you to join in the work of remaking this nation.
When we looked at President-elect Obama's campaign, I think those of us who were involved in community organizing immediately saw several things that were going on that was clear, community organizing principles.
Everybody, it's David Plouffe. We'd like you to go to mybarackobama.com/changeiscoming and register to host a house party to attend.
A community organizing presidency is a presidency that assumes that there is going to be an organized participation of citizens.
Hi, my name's Kay, and this is my house.
Hi. Come on in.
I organized this house meeting for the Obama transition team to talk about issues that are important to us here in Brooklyn.
I saw the thing I just signed up about 20 minutes ago.
Oh, good. Well, I'm so glad.
I'm Kay's brother, Lewis Marshall.
Coming out of the cold.
Kay and I organized. This is our fifth house meeting and first one after the campaign.
I'm Wendy. Hi.
Lewis. Adam.
At the heart of good community organizing is learning how to build relationships, new relationships built on shared self-interest. He said, okay, let me take the principles that I learned in Chicago where we bring people together in apartments and begin to process and talk about what their shared self-interest is. And let's do that with Facebook. Let's do that with MySpace, which just blew up, right?
I had signed up for mybarackobama.com. So you just go on and say, you know, this is a date, this is a time. I'm having a house party. Do you want to come? And total strangers sign up and come to your house to talk about issues.
And then the campaign, or I guess the, I don't know what we call them now, the movement, has a video.
Hi. I'm Nikki Sutton, an online organizer for Obama for America, and I want to thank you so much for participating in a Change is Coming house meeting.
This is not mind control. This is not President-elect Obama trying to figure out how to seduce the nation and get them to drink the Kool-Aid here. I think this is President Obama trying to take advantage of the inspiration that has been released by his campaign and go out there and help people get organized so their voices can be heard.
Well, once you sign up to do a meeting, they send you an email thanking you for doing it, and then they ask you to talk about what issues are important, brainstorm ways to build relationships with local politicians.
These people who are meeting in these house meetings, who are going to go out and meet with their city councilors and their educators from the educational board.
Is David Yasky your councilman?
They're developing an appetite for political policy, and they're getting the sense that my involvement actually can make a difference.
To actually want to spend my Saturday afternoon talking about health care and the war in Afghanistan and how the president should be making his decisions, going to the internet and typing it up and sending it in to him is really kind of an amazing thing.
Right now, I'm most upset about the plan to escalate the war in Afghanistan.
One of the major problems of the presidency is that you get trapped in a bubble and that you get disconnected from what everyday people are thinking and feeling and experiencing.
The contrary, the issue that's most central to me is wealth disparity.
And you see how they organize in the House meetings now. I suspect he's going to use that on a regular basis at the very minimum. Keeps him in touch with where people are and what they're thinking.
I know that they're not, you know, every email that I send to them, I don't expect that anyone near President Obama is reading them, but the hope is that they'll continue to have them to give people an opportunity to give feedback on where we think the government should be going.
What about a rethinking of the tax code? Is that something
It's been for me personally a rebirth of a kind of idealism. and a sense of hope. And that, if that sounds corny, it's too bad. Just the fact that strangers would come together and somebody else's kind of CD parlor to have those conversations, that's just, to me, remarkable.
I think most people in America recognize that the problems that we face are extraordinarily complex, know that this is not going to be an overnight solution. He does have to be cautious not to raise expectations too high. But at the end of the day, he is certainly in no worse place by doing this.
He wants us to be there as the sort of foot soldiers to support when the stuff comes through, but then, I mean, we have a role to push him to go further, which is not to say attack him or...
I think President-elect Obama has the same vantage point as President Roosevelt and President Johnson, who both in separate occasions are on the record saying to people who came in to see them with very good ideals, that's a very good ideal, now go out there and make me do it. The suggestion is that presidents have to respond to, in many instances, where the political pressure is coming from. That's just the reality of politics.
I have to admit, there's some part of me that was sitting here the other night. We kept having that problem deciding it's not the campaign anymore, it's the administration. And I kept hearing this funny voice in my head from my old commie cousins from the passing, it's the revolution. Well, we obviously don't want to build something like that.
No, I was just going to say that we have to, you know what we want him to do and just, you know, keep after him. I mean, like everyone else is going to. Everyone.
So I hope he builds a, I hesitate to say a machine, but I hope he builds an organization that has a real sense of organic interconnectedness all the way up and all the way down.
So I think what has happened is that he will have a series of House meetings. Out of those House meetings will come a distilled list of priorities, and he'll see how that jives with what he's thinking. Make the adjustments. He will act. He will begin to implement. Then he'll come back to House meetings again across the country and get a sense of how those policies now being implemented, how they're playing out and affecting the real lives of real people. And then they'll make adjustments. I think that's where he's trying to get to.
I think in terms of issues, I don't know if anybody else has any...
Was this what we were supposed to do?
Yeah.
I mean,
more or less.
That story was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler. We heard from Reverend Herman Hamilton, a community organizer, along with Kay and Lewis Marshall, a brother and sister who hosted an Obama House meeting in Brooklyn. They say they plan on doing this for the next 8 years. On their website, the Obama team has passed on some of what they got back from those House meetings and from an online survey. Some interesting information here. 86% said that they plan to help Obama pass legislation through grassroots support. 68% said it's important to also work on state and local races. And 10% say that they would like to run for public office themselves.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA program.
It may look like a bunch of junk buried in the ground, but it's actually a time capsule. Or maybe it's just a bunch of junk buried in the ground. We'll dig it up ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. All right, so it's January, right? That means you're very likely to be in one of two groups. New member at the gym, or old member at the gym who can't get on one of the elliptical machines at the gym because some new member is on it all the time. Dang new members. The online slang compendium UrbanDictionary.com has a name for these people. January joiners defines them as someone who joins the gym in January as part of a New Year's resolution and by February is back to being a couch potato. Reporter Rebecca Shear knows one such person who swears this year it's going to be different.
Eliana is an aspiring actress in Brooklyn, New York. She didn't want us to use her last name. She's 31, about 5'3", with this amazing explosion of long red curls. And this year, she's decided to hit the gym.
I've resolved to join gyms before, to attend the gyms I've joined before. In New York alone, I have belonged to... Okay, hold on. I'm going to answer this in a second because I have to count.
Across a span of New Year's, Eliana's joined 5 different gyms.
Six, actually.
6 different gyms.
Right, yeah.
Soon to be 7.
I have access to a gym in the same building where I work, and I never go. So actually making use of that is one of my resolutions.
Eliana's already made her resolutions. She always starts early.
Sometimes it's specifically lose X number of unreasonable pounds, and a lot of the time it's just get in better shape and treat my body with more respect and so on and so forth. But a lot of the time it has to do with losing weight.
That's because 10 years ago when Eliana came home from college, she weighed a lot.
About 212 pounds.
And she was sick, she was depressed. So in December of that year, she made her very first resolution. Her doctor prescribed a diet, and in 8 months, Eliana had lost 50 pounds.
That I kept off for 2 years, but it started creeping back up.
So every year, she resolved to creep it back down. You know, go on another diet, join another gym.
Every time I quote-unquote January joined, I've often been like the type of joiner who sort of falls off of a resolution or drops a resolution and beats myself up.
And that's the problem with resolutions. Robin Abrams writes the misconduct column for the Boston Globe. She's a former psychology professor and stand-up comedian and knows a lot about the January joining syndrome and how to avoid it. First off, she says, don't use pass or fail language, words like quit.
I'm going to quit this.
Never.
I will never do this again. I will never have another cigarette again.
And every day.
That's setting yourself up to fail because if you say I'm going to work on my novel or meditate or do whatever every day, well, the first day... you don't meditate, you've broken your resolution.
You should also shy away from black and white thinking. Like, say you resolve to give up junk food, and you have a piece of cake at a birthday party, and at that point you figure,
well, I've broken the resolution, I may as well just go out and eat the grande tostita fat bomb lardo magneto macho nachos for dinner, and you just fall completely off the wagon in every possible sense. That's what you really want to avoid.
But Abrams says the worst thing of all is setting the bar too high.
That's sort of the idea that if I go to the gym 3 times a week, I'm going to look like Angelina Jolie. Instead of focusing on that, just focus on get to the gym.
And that's what Eliana says she's doing this year. Yes, she's dreamed of looking like Angelina Jolie in the past, but this time around her dreams involve other things. She wants to bring down the house in a Broadway musical, or at least take up martial arts.
Do I think I have the stamina and the strength to A, like sing 8 shows a week, or B, flip some guy over my back? Those are the things I would like to be options for me. And that's the incentive to be January joining like one last time.
Eliana's dreams may be big, but her resolution is smaller, just to be healthy, which means watching what she eats, taking her vitamins, and getting her body moving.
January is a new beginning, and I like January as a start point, but it's always New Year's sometime. Like, you can make your own January if you have to.
And just in case, Eliana's already got January 26th marked on her calendar, the start of the Chinese New Year. I'm Rebecca Shear for Weekend America.
Thank you.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. With the new year comes the annual opportunity to put yourself on the line, to set yourself up for improvement, dedication, empowerment, or to set yourself up for frustration, futility, disappointment. Talking, of course, about the New Year's resolution. An annual proclamation of the new you. Easy to declare on New Year's Eve, perhaps a bit trickier on January 3rd. We asked you, our listeners, what you resolved to do this year. Here's what you told us, beginning with Danny Clayton.
I want to learn to play the guitar. The way I look at it is like if there's 365 days in a year, I have over 300 opportunities this year to do something of note so that when 2010 rolls around, I can look back and say, I did X, I did Y, I did Z, and I did a number of things. And so what I've decided to do is go without television for a whole year. That's no TV programming at all.
I'm Christina Knight from Minneapolis, Minnesota. My New Year's resolution is to have fewer sense of humor failures. I have had trouble maintaining my sense of humor and controlling my temper while taking care of my child and daycare children. It might be counting 1 to 10. It might be saying, children, you stay here while I go sit in the other room. It will be taking a deep breath and letting it out slowly.
York, Pennsylvania. Now I'm in Dallas, Texas. I believe my New Year's resolution this year is going to be the same as it's been for the past 30 plus years that I've been driving a truck, to not have an accident, not cause an accident, and watch out for the other drivers and cars that are on the road to make sure that they arrive at their destination safely.
My name is Kaya Kostelitsky, and I'm from Kent, Washington. My New Year's resolution is to get a better job and to be a better parent to my daughter. I work in fast food, and I usually only work 2 shifts a week. And I can't blame my bosses. I don't walk very fast, and I don't do things as well as I used to be able to do them. But let me see. I can work in an office. I could probably work in a grocery store or a retail establishment. I'll be able to get a job. I'm not sure when or where, but I'll be okay until I do.
Unfortunately, searching for a new job is probably on a lot of people's resolution lists this year. But take heart, America. It is possible to find one, according to Joan Cochran. 30 years ago, she resolved to improve her own career path, and it all started with a phone call to a radio station.
I was working at a gentleman's social club up on Nob Hill in San Francisco. I called into a radio station. What happened was they said, would you make a news, you know, do you have a New Year's resolution to make? And I said, yes, I do. I want a new job. And then it really started to focus me on what I needed to do. So I kind of redoubled my efforts towards getting a new job, and it seemed to work out. The job as a park ranger actually came true, and I got to quit my nighttime job and work outside on Alcatraz Island. And I worked as a park ranger there. You might think it in your head, but when you actually come out and say it in public, and in some cases broadcast over the airwaves, what happens is people make a commitment towards doing what they need to do to meet that resolution.
Heard from Danny Clayton, Christina Knights, Douglas Smith, Kaya Kostelitsky, and Joan Cochran. Tell us what resolutions you've made. Let us know how they're going for you. Go to our website, weekendamerica.org. Resolutions have 1 foot in the past and 1 foot in the future, partially 2008, partially 2009, the you that you were, the you you hope to be. Our next story also straddles time, and it's fueled by what I think is an inherent determined optimism and maybe a little bit of arrogance that humans as a species have. It's about time capsules and how we bury things because we are convinced that future generations will find them and want them and think we are fascinating.
To the person who shall open this box deposited in the cornerstone of the Institute of Anatomy, Tuesday, September 5th, 1911.
There are thousands of time capsules buried by school children, civic leaders, colleges, and hospitals across the country every year in the United States. Weekend America's Sasha Aslanian wondered what fuels our urge to freeze time and bury these, well, treasures?
Time capsules were a big deal when I was a kid. It was 1976, the bicentennial, one of those grand occasions when grown-ups take stock of where we are in this moment in time, and school kids make projects.
There's something primal about time capsules.
That's historian Paul Hudson.
It's like a buried treasure, and I guess all of us, or certainly I as a child, would bury things, and quite often I would dig it up in the afternoon. I'd be so excited to see it.
Hudson still feels that excitement. In 1990, he co-founded the International Time Capsule Society at Oglethorpe University in Atlanta. Hudson says America has gone time capsule crazy. We're a young country, impatient to make history. We love to gather the ephemera of pop culture, the Wonder Bras, beer cans, newspapers. Something we've touched will be remembered long after we're gone. It's a kind of immortality for ourselves and for our objects.
What happens to most time capsules is they become lost or forgotten.
Hudson thinks the fate of time capsules reflects the foibles of human nature. We have the best of intentions, but we're disorganized and forgetful. And some time capsules, even if they're found, turn out to be disasters.
I think you're seeing something that's been set away for 50 years.
Tulsa, Oklahoma, unearthed its 50-year time capsule in 2007. There was a lot of excitement because the city had buried a car.
Of course, the bad news is we're not going to be able to get it running.
The two-tone 1957 Chrysler Belvedere with fins was completely rusted through. Miss Belvedere, as she's known in Tulsa, has spent the past year and a half in a New Jersey auto body shop that volunteered to clean her up. Tulsa has a new time capsule car stowed away for the next 50 years, this time above ground. 50 years falls within a human lifespan, but some time capsules hope to reach people much farther into the future. Paul Hudson describes the most ambitious time capsule on record.
The granddaddy of all time capsules is where the International Time Capsule Society is at Oglethorpe University, where Dr. Thornwell Jacobs seals something that he called the Crypt of Civilization. He sealed it in 1940, and it was not to be opened, and I hope everyone is sitting down here, not to be opened until 8113 AD.
Thornwell Jacobs was inspired by the ancient Egyptian pyramids, accidental time capsules. Instead of the Rosetta Stone, the Crypt of Civilization's got a hand crank machine inside that will teach anyone basic English.
And people used to ask Dr. Jacobs, you know, what will life be like in 8113 AD. And he said he could no more envision life in 8113 AD than Cro-Magnon man could envision the skyline of New York.
Technology is making it easier to reach future generations. We have the ability to store vast amounts of digital information far above our earthly fray. The European Space Agency is planning to launch a satellite that intends to contain messages from all humanity. They have 4 pages reserved for you. The Europeans want to leave something for our descendants 50,000 years from now. That makes Thornwell Jacobs' Crypt of Civilization a mere baby step along the way. Patrick Tejador is with the European Space Agency project KEO.
50,000 years was because on our history, the human history on Earth, 50,000 years ago, for the first time, the human body was drawing somewhere.
Drawing in caves, in France, in Africa, It was no New York skyline, but it was human beings' first art. Patrick Tejedor says it's our turn to create a message for the future.
In thousands of years, your own message will be read by someone in the earth. So someone will think to you at that time.
It's a nice thought, but suddenly I'm feeling very small. The bicentennial time capsules I made when I was a kid made me feel big and important. We had modern inventions compared to those founding fathers in their silly hats. But 50,000 years from now, will they find our messages? Time capsule historian Paul Hudson doesn't make me feel too encouraged about that. But we have to keep hoping. That's what humans do. In St. Paul, I'm Sasha Aslanian for Weekend America.
If you'd like to send your message into space, we have a link to the KEO site at weekendamerica.org. Or you can do it terrestrially. Paul Hudson suggests making family time capsules by writing a letter to your future children or grandchildren. Just don't bury it for 50 years in Oklahoma, okay? The Old Farmer's Almanac is predicting a colder-than-usual winter ahead, a sluggish spring, a stormy summer. Geez, even good weather is in a recession. For some ideas on how to have fun, regardless, here's Jeannie Yandel.
Only a select few can be race car drivers, but racing remote control cars is a little more inclusive, and Fergus Falls, Minnesota holds the Grand Prix of remote control car races. Snowy and 18 degrees, fabulous weather to go inside and see how your toy car fares on the race course. Here's a tip. Your remote control car will go faster if you go brrm, brrm while racing it. Scientific fact. Fruitcake is hardly known as an enjoyable snack, so you'd be forgiven for thinking a fruitcake toss is more a gastrointestinal event than a competitive one. But Manitou Springs, Colorado insists their fruitcake toss is an upchuck-free affair. Sunny in 44 to hurl fruitcake, ooh, that's misleading, for distance or accuracy, then dust them off and re-gift them next year. Ice fishing is usually a contest of man versus fish. Boring, says Phillips, Wisconsin. They're upping the ante at their ice fishing rumble. Snowy in 18 as fishermen battle walleye, bluegill, and perch, and each other. Arrive early for the ice fisherman gang knife fight. Kidding, the gangs will just do an on-ice dance-off to Michael Jackson's Beat It. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
How do obscure, unsigned bands become the next big thing that we all listen to on the radio constantly? Turns out it comes down to the tastes of only a few people. Meet them next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. All through the show today, we're looking ahead at what 2009 might be like. A new president, a lot of economic uncertainty, but how about something a little artier? What kind of music might we be hearing? Turns out that is not very easy to predict either. No easier than the economy, in fact. But we asked reporter Roman Mars to take a crack at it anyway.
I'm sorry. I love radio and radio listeners. Hello, everyone. But the way you're going to be exposed to new music in 2009 is the way you probably heard it last year on a TV show or a commercial. TV is the new radio, and TV's new DJs are people like Alexandra Patsavas, who has a company in Los Angeles called Chop Shop Music Supervision.
The music supervisor is hired by a producer or director,
and we get involved in every musical aspect of a project. I'm lucky enough to work on shows like Gossip Girl and Chuck and Grey's Anatomy, and also I just finished work on the movie Twilight.
Because of her job, Patsavas knows what you're going to hear way ahead of you.
In the last couple of days, I've heard new music by Glass Pear, which I think will have a big impact in the future. Beautiful, melodic, well-crafted pop songs. Yeah, we live
and we breathe. This is the song Vultures by a band you probably will hear a lot more from, Glass Pear. But Patsavas doesn't find her music in a vacuum. Oh no. To keep an edge, she turns to sources like the music blog Brooklyn Vegan.
They have a healthy respect for new music, but also are not afraid to give their opinion.
I reached Brooklyn Vegan staff writer Bill Paris at 10:30 p.m. pulling a late shift at his friend's video store in Brooklyn.
Videology.
Hi, is this Bill?
This is.
It turns out that being a great music journalist at a popular website means you probably have another job on the side.
I do a weekly column called This Week in Indie. I sort of cover bands that may have fallen through the cracks otherwise. Find a cure for my life, find a cure. Find a cure for my life, find a cure.
There's
actually a singer from Norway named Ida Maria, who's finally going to have her debut album come out in America sometime first quarter 2009, and she's definitely somebody to watch. Her voice is a little bit like Bjork's, but she's more sort of like a PJ Harvey type. She gets on stage and she just becomes this like spitfire, and she usually ends up like writhing on the floor of the stage. Anybody that goes to see her live will become an instant convert. And I think that she will do fairly well over here, and she certainly does deserve it.
So thanks in part to Brooklyn Vegan blogger Bill Paris, we might be hearing lots of Ida Maria this year, which I could actually get behind. But Bill is not the end of the chain.
As much as we bloggers like to think that we're like really in the know, I think record store clerks still know more than we do, because they're working somewhere where they listen to music 12 hours a day.
Fetus Records, how can I help you?
Hi, my name is Roman Mars. I'm a reporter for a program called Week in America.
What?
You have a second to talk to me?
Just one minute. We're actually kind of busy.
1 minute.
I really need this guy, because this is the soldier on the front line, the clerk at Electric Fetus, one of the great local record stores in Minneapolis.
What I'm doing this story on is like music trends for 2009, and I was wondering if you could just tell me one release that you're excited about for 2009.
One release. Oh, I got to narrow it down.
Well, you can tell me five releases if you want to.
This cool new album by these guys called the Menahan Street Band. It's an instrumental soul, kind of R&B, little jazzy feel to it. But yeah, really solid album.
And that's out now?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, sure thing.
Take care.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, if in 2009 you hear the Menahan Street Band, just know that it came from the source of sources, Dylan, the record store guy. Dylan's more than a person, he's a platonic ideal. He certainly is for Mark Wheat, who hangs out the Electric Fetus all the time trying to figure out what you are going to be listening to before he goes on, wait for it, the radio.
This is Mark Wheat. I'm the evening host on 89.3 The Current out of Minnesota Public Radio in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Especially this year, 2009, all bets are off. I think if anybody tries to predict anything this year at the turn of the year, they're slightly insane.
Times are strange, the economy's a mess, the album is dying, the music industry in general doesn't know what the hell is going on, but Mark still has to find new music for you Minnesotans and the public at large. So here you go.
on a local level, I'm really excited about a new band called Ultra Chorus, which is one of the guys who used to have a band called Suck Patch, which actually in the Twin Cities were doing a similar style of music in the mid-90s, late 90s to bands like MGMT. And thinking back, Suck Patch were kind of ahead of the curve there. So he sent me a 5-song EP, and it was like every song we could play on the radio.
This is Words Kept Talking by Ultra Chorus, an unsigned band self-releasing singles and getting played on a big radio station because they're good, and the DJ actually likes them. In 2009, that seems marvelously, beautifully old-fashioned. In San Francisco, I'm Roman Mars for Weekend America.
If you happen to be in London on Tuesday night, go to the Bullet Bar. You can catch Glass Pear live in concert. That's one of the bands they were just talking about. And I can imagine that's going to be a little bit like catching U2 at some obscure club in Ireland in the early 1980s. Something to check out. A quick glance over at the Electric Fetus website reveals bands like Bon Iver, Fleet Foxes, but also some old standards you might have heard about. Folks like Neil Young and Bob Dylan. Robert Plant is on there as well. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of this entire program at weekendamerica.org or at iTunes. It's a great way of taking the weekend with you all throughout the week. Carry it with you right in your ears. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
The weekend is the perfect time to sit back and reflect.
There is some kind of sense of isolation and desolation that makes it like a dream moving around in some of these landscapes.
Look, traveling all across this nation can get expensive. Let us do it for you. I'm John Moe, host of Weekend America. Every week we take you across the country and show you what your friends and neighbors are doing and thinking. Join us.